vocabularies. Politeness versus profanity. Verisimilitude versus verse. Understatement versus overstatement. And countless other examples of stylistics and wordplay. Dialogue can dance to as many different tunes as life can sing. I have emphasized the infinite array of creative possibilities that face the writer a few times already and will again. I repeat this point because I want writers to understand that form does not limit expression. It inspires it. This book explores the forms that underlie dialogue, but never proposes formula for writing it. Creativity is choice-making. Paralanguage. Actors provide their audiences with all forms of paralanguage, those non-lexical nuances of voice and body language that enhance the meanings and feelings of words, facial expression, gestures, posture, rate of words, pitch, volume, rhythm, intonation, stress, and even proxemics, the distances characters keep between themselves and others. An actor's paralanguage speaks a gesticulate dialogue. The eye of the audience reads these micro-expressions at up to 1/25th of a second. On page, however, paralanguage calls for description enhanced with figurative language. In this example from Railroad Incident, August 1995, a short story by David Means, four homeless men sit around a fire at night when a half-dressed man comes out of the shadows.
What they saw emerge was a man softening into middle age. In his limp was a slight residue of dignity and formality, the way he lifted his feet as if they were still shod and weighted by the expensive shoes. Or maybe all of that wasn't noticed until, coming up to them, he opened his mouth and spoke, saying hello softly, the vowels widening, the cup of his mouth over those words like an expensive shell.
David Means writes short stories, I suspect, because his arsenal of prose techniques is so diverse, he needs hundreds of tellings to explore them all. Mixed techniques. Prose techniques can be used one at a time or in concert. In this exchange from An American Dream, Norman Mailer weaves three. Direct dialogue, first-person direct address, and paralanguage, both literal and figurative.
You want a divorce? I said.
I think so.
Like that?
Not like that, darling, after all that.
She yawned prettily and looked for a moment like a 15-year-old Irish maid.
When you didn't come by today to say goodbye to Deirdre.
I didn't know she was leaving.
Of course you didn't know. How could you know? You've been nuzzling and nipping with your little girls.
She did not know that at the moment I had no girl. They're not so little anymore. A fire had begun to spread in me. It was burning now in my stomach, and my lungs were dry as old leaves. My heart had a herded pressure which gave promise to explode. Give us a bit of the rum, I said.
A quick point about adaptation from medium to medium. If you wish to adapt a prose story to the screen, recognize that novelists and short story writers tend to concentrate their finest dialogue in the voices of their narrators, not in the dialogue of their dramatized scenes, as Mailer just did. Literature resists filmic adaptation for the obvious reason. The camera cannot photograph thought. Inner dialogues of concentrated prose cannot shift sideways from page to screen. Therefore, to adapt, you must reinvent. You must re-envision the novel's storytelling from the inside out and transform its novelistic narratized dialogue into filmic dramatized dialogue. No small task. Line design. A line's design pivots around its key term, the word or phrase essential to its meaning. An author can place that key term first, last, or anywhere in the middle. That choice results in one of three fundamental line designs: suspenseful, cumulative, balanced. The suspense sentence. Curiosity drives the thirst for knowledge, our intellectual need to solve puzzles and answer questions. Empathy drives the hunger for connection, our emotional need to identify with others and root for their well-being. When the rational and emotional sides of life merge, they generate the phenomenon of suspense. Suspense, simply put, is curiosity charged with empathy. Suspense focuses the reader or the audience by flooding the mind with emotionally tinged questions that hook and hold attention. What's going to happen next? What'll happen after that? What will the protagonist do, feel? And the major dramatic question that hangs suspended over the entire telling, how will this turn out? These powerful questions so grip our concentration that time vanishes. As events build to story climax, suspense intensifies and peaks at the final and irreversible turning point that answers the major dramatic question and ends the telling. This combination of curiosity and concern arcs the story's overall suspense, but when we zoom in for a close-up, we see that inquisitive emotions permeate every story component, no matter its size. Each scene dramatizes a suspense-filled turning point. Each speech within the scene grips interest from first line to last. Even the smallest element of all, the line of dialogue, shapes itself into a miniature unit of suspense. A superbly told story holds unbroken intellectual and emotional involvement, scene by scene, speech by speech, line by line. The reader never pauses, and the audience never looks away, not for a moment. The key to composing dialogue that holds the eye to the page and the ear to the stage and screen is the periodic sentence. A periodic sentence withholds its core idea until the final word. By front-loading the sentence with modifiers or subordinate ideas, and thus delaying the meaning to last, the periodic sentence compels uninterrupted interest. For example, if you didn't want me to do it, why did you give me that blank? What word would give that line its specific meaning? Look, gun, kiss, nod, photo, money, report, smile, email, ice cream sundae, almost any noun imaginable could nail the meaning. To inspire intrigue, the periodic design makes meaning wait, thus compels the reader or the audience to listen in wonder from first word to the last. In other words, the periodic sentence is the suspense sentence. For example, the opening scene from Art, a play by Yasmina Ritza, translated by Christopher Hampton. Listen to the emphasis of the core word or phrase in each sentence. Mark, alone on stage. My friend Serge has bought a painting. It's a canvas about 5 foot by 4, white. The background is white. If you screw up your eyes, you can make out some fine, white, diagonal lines. Serge is one of my oldest friends, done well for himself. He's a dermatologist, and he's keen on art. On Monday, I went to see the painting. Serge actually got a hold of it on Saturday, but he's been lusting after it for several months, this white painting with white lines. At Serge's, at floor level, a white canvas with fine white diagonal scars. Serge looks at his painting, thrilled. Mark looks at the painting. Serge looks at Mark, looking at the painting. Long silence. From both of them, a whole range of wordless emotions. Expensive?
$200,000.
$200,000?
Huntington would take it off my hands for $220,000.
Who's that?
Huntington?
Never heard of him.
Huntington, the Huntington Gallery.
The Huntington Gallery would take it off your hands for $220,000?
No, not the gallery. Him. Huntington himself, for his own collection.
Then why didn't Huntington buy it?
It's important for them to sell to private clients. That's how the market circulates. Well? You're not in the right place. Look at it from this angle. Can you see the lines?
What's the name of the...
Painter, Antrios.
Well known.
Very, very.
Pause. Serge, you haven't bought this painting for 200,000 euros?
You don't understand. That's what it costs in an Antrios.
You haven't bought this painting for 200,000 euros.
I might have known you'd missed the point.
You paid 200,000 euros for this shit? Serge, as if alone.
My friend Mark's an intelligent enough fellow. I've always valued our relationship. He has a good job. He's an aeronautical engineer. But he's one of those new-style intellectuals who are not only enemies of modernism, but seem to take some sort of incomprehensible pride in running it down.
Of the 45 ideas expressed in these two soliloquies of narratized dialogue, and the scene of dramatized dialogue they bracket, 40 are shaped for suspense. Even the brief description of paralanguage, the nonverbal facial expressions on Mark and Serge, delays its point until the phrase, wordless emotions. The suspense sentence is not only the most dramatic design, but the most comic as well. Almost all verbal jokes trigger laughter by ending on a suspense sentence that suddenly severs the rising tension with a final punch word. By saving the core word for last, Ritza and Hampton energize their lines, hold the audience's interest, and concentrate impact into a single final, often comic, punch. The cumulative sentence. How old is the cumulative technique? Aristotle advocated it over 2,300 years ago. In Book 3, Part 9 of On Rhetoric, he examined the differences between the tight, periodic suspense sentence and the loose, free-running cumulative sentence. The two designs reverse mirror each other. The suspense structure puts subordinate phrases first and ends on its core word. The cumulative design puts its core word up front, then follows with subordinate phrases that develop or modify the point. Consider the line design in character B's dialogue.
Remember Jack?
Smoke circling his head like an angry halo. Cigarette butt burning his lip, wrestling the spare, cursing the jack, trying to fix a flat. Last time I ever saw him.
When we reverse the design, the suspense sentence turns into a cumulative sentence.
Remember Jack?
I saw him. Last time ever. Trying to fix a flat, cursing the jack, wrestling with the spare, cigarette butt burning his lip, smoke circling his head like an angry halo.
Although the free-running, cumulative style may be less dramatic than a suspense sentence, it's not slapdash. When well-crafted, it paints an ever-growing, more detailed picture of its subject. This snowballing quality gives dialogue a conversational spontaneity while its phrases roll out with a pleasing rhythm. The suspense design offers many advantages, but drawbacks as well. First, the meaning, constantly delayed, risks sounding contrived. Second, a long suspense sentence may force the reader or audience to remember too many pieces of a complex idea while waiting for the ending to pull the thoughts together. If overwritten, a suspense sentence takes on the same tedious feebleness of a badly built cumulative sentence. The suspense and cumulative designs sit at opposite ends of the spectrum, between opening a line with its core word versus closing with it runs countless variations. Parallel designs, for example, link phrases of similar length, meaning, and design for contrast and emphasis. When I walked into that church, I walked into a new life. The balanced sentence. The balanced sentence puts its core word or words somewhere in the middle with subordinate phrases on either side.
Jack's sex and gambling obsessions are high risk enough, but I think the guy must be an adrenaline junkie when I add his rock climbing and skydiving.
The suspense sentence, straight or in parallel, is dialogue's most compelling and dramatic design. So for tension, emphasis, flourish, and laughs, delay the core word. On the other hand, cumulative and balanced sentences are the most conversational and free-running designs. But the constant use of any single technique becomes as repetitious as wallpaper and artificial as a robot. Therefore, to compel involvement and build tension, while at the same time expressing a sense of characters living in the moment and making up whatever they say, dialogue calls for a mixture of designs. Mixed designs. In season 1, episode 3 of True Detective, the co-protagonist, Rustin Cole, relates his worldview to detectives Gilbro and Papania. Once again, listen to the emphasis of the core words. Note where each is located within its sentence. By the way, DB is cop talk for dead body.
This is what I'm talking about. This is what I mean when I'm talking about time and death and futility. All right, there are broader ideas at work, mainly what is owed between us as a society for our mutual illusions. 14 straight hours of staring at DBs. These are the things you think of. You ever done that? You look in their eyes, even in a picture. Doesn't matter if they're dead or alive, you can still read them. You know what you see? They welcomed it. Not at first, but right there in the last instant. It's an unmistakable relief. See, 'cause they were afraid, and now they saw for the very first time how easy it was to just let go. Yeah, they saw in that last nanosecond, they saw what they were. You, yourself, this whole big drama, it was never more than a jerry-rig of presumption and dumb will, and you could just let go. To finally know that you didn't have to hold on so tight. To realize that all your life, all your love, all your hate, all your memories, all your pain, it was all the same thing. It was all the same dream, a dream you had inside a locked room, a dream about being a person. And like a lot of dreams, there's a monster at the end of it.
Of the 20-plus ideas Rust expresses, a dozen use suspense sentences, and the rest are a mix of balanced, parallel, and cumulative structures. As a result, this long passage hooks, builds, and pays off interest, yet seems spontaneous, almost wandering. Note also how series creator and writer Nick Pizzolatto caps Rust's speech with a metaphor. Life is a dream, like a grace note that enhances a passage of music, a trope tagged on a suspense sentence can add a mind-catching ornament. Economy. One final but critical quality of expressive dialogue is economy, saying the maximum in the fewest possible words. All fine writing, especially of dialogue, follows the principle of economy as laid down by William Strunk Jr. and E.B. White in The Elements of Style. Vigorous writing is concise. A sentence should contain no unnecessary words, a paragraph no unnecessary sentences, for the same reason that a drawing should have no unnecessary lines and a machine no unnecessary parts. This requires not that the writer make all of his sentences short, or that he avoid all detail and treat his subjects only in outline, but that he make every word tell. Not vacuity, but economy. This principle became the Strunk and White imperative, omit needless words. Do your writing a favor and tape that dictate to your computer screen, then do it. No speech, no matter the length, should ask the reader or the audience to absorb one more word than necessary. Extraneous language annoys us. Omit it. In Chapter 18, the dialogue of Sofia Coppola's film Lost in Translation executes the principle of economy with perfection. The pause. Inside the give and take of dialogue, the pause serves many uses. When used prior to a turning point, a moment of wordless hesitation tightens tension in the reader or the audience, focuses their attention on what will happen next, and emphasizes the gravity of the event. A pause after a turning point allows the reader or audience time to absorb the meaning of the change and savor its aftermath. A pre-crisis pause dams emotional momentum. In a well-written scene, curiosity and concern flow toward the moment of critical change. The reader or the audience asks itself, what's going to happen next? What's she going to do when it does? How will this turn out? As this impetus peaks, a pause holds it in check and compresses its power. When the turning point pivots, all that pent-up energy explodes into the scene's climactic beat. Overused, however, the pause, like talk, can wear out its welcome. The principle of economy applies as much to this tactic as any other. If dialogue halts again and again and again to signal emphasis, 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 nothing gets emphasis. Like The Boy Who Cried Wolf, the more often an author repeats a technique, the less effect it has. Then when the scene arrives in which she wants the tactic to deliver its full effect, she discovers that repetition has blunted its edge. Be judicious in the placement of pauses. Shape the rhythm of scenes without undue hesitation so that when you put on the brakes, the standstill moment grips attention. There are no free rests. A pause must be earned. The case for silence. Lean, pacey dialogue, more implicit than explicit, keeps readers and audiences hungry for more. Stuffed, sluggish speeches, more explicit than implicit, discourage interest. As overwritten dialogue wears on and on, the reader skims, the audience stops listening. So, in the same way that tragic scenes often call for comic relief, surplus of talk may call for silence. From story to story, scene to scene, how much is too much is impossible to say. Your taste and judgment must guide that decision, but if you feel that your pages overtalk their scenes, switch gears and write for the eye rather than the ear, make image substitute for language. Challenge yourself with this question. How could I write this scene in a purely visual way, doing all that needs to be done for character and story without resorting to a single line of dialogue. You can call upon the power of images in one of two ways. One, paralanguage. Gestures and facial expression are not, strictly speaking, linguistic. Nonetheless, they can speak with all the overtones and undertones of words. So rather than cluttering scenes with the verbalized affirmations or disaffirmations such as yes, no, I agree, I disagree, or I think you're right, I think you're wrong, carry the moment with a nod, a glance, a wave of the hand. This is especially true when writing for television and film. Whenever possible, leave room for the actor's creativity. Because the camera can magnify a face many times larger than life, thoughts and emotions seem to flow behind the eyes and under the skin like swells across a sea. Silence invites the camera in. Use it. Two, physical action. At every opportunity, ask yourself this question. What physical rather than verbal behavior could execute my character's actions and reactions? Let your imagination paint word pictures of doing rather than saying. Consider, for example, a scene from a film by Ingmar Bergman with an apt title in this context, The Silence. In it, a woman in a hotel restaurant allows herself to be seduced by a waiter. How to write that? Does the waiter offer her a menu, listing the specials of the day? Does he recommend his favorite dishes? Does he compliment her on how she's dressed? Does he ask her if she's staying at the hotel, traveling far? Does he ask if she knows the city? Does he mention that he's getting off work in an hour and would love to show her the sights? Talk, talk, talk. Here's how Bergman played it. The waiter, accidentally on purpose, drops a napkin on the floor next to her chair. As he slowly stoops and kneels to pick it up, he sniffs and smells the woman from head to crotch to foot. She, in reaction, inhales a deep, pleasure-filled sigh. Bergman then cuts to a hotel room where the customer and the waiter writhe in passion. Their intensely erotic, visual, physical, wordless seduction in the restaurant executes its turning point on her inhale. Silence is the ultimate economy of language. Part 2. Flaws and Fixes. Introduction. 6 Dialogue Tasks. Effective dialogue executes 6 tasks simultaneously. 1. Each verbal expression takes an inner action. 2. Each beat of action-reaction intensifies the scene, building to and around its turning point. 3. Statements and allusions within the lines convey exposition. 4. A unique verbal style characterizes each role. 5. The flow of progressive beats captivates the reader audience, carrying them on a wave of narrative drive, unaware of the passage of time. 6. The language strikes the reader and audience as authentic in its setting and true to character, thus maintaining belief in the story's fictional reality. Fine dialogue harmonizes all 6 of these objectives at once. So let's look at the various faults that break the flow and cause discord. Chapter 6. Credibility Flaws. Incredibility. The standards of credibility we set for the physical behaviors of characters apply equally to what they say. Dialogue written for television, stage, or film must inspire believable performances in its actors. Scenes written for a novel or short story must inspire the reader to imagine credible behaviors in literary characters. So, no matter how complex and compelling the psychology of your characters, no matter how emotional and meaningful your story design, If your characters do not talk in a manner true to their natures, true to the setting and genre, the reader or audience loses faith. Unconvincing dialogue destroys interest faster than sour notes destroy a recital. Hollow, phony dialogue cannot be cured with naturalism. If you eavesdrop on the conversations of your fellow passengers on planes, trains, and buses, you realize in a flash that you would never put those gossipy bull sessions on stage, page, or screen. Actual chatter repeats like a dribbling basketball. Everyday talk lacks vividness, resonance, expressivity, and most critically, significance. Business meetings, for example, often roll on and on, hour after hour, without metaphor, simile, trope, or imagery of the least expressivity. The critical difference between conversation and dialogue is not the number, choice, or arrangement of words. The difference is content. Dialogue concentrates meaning. Conversation dilutes it. Therefore, even in the most realistic settings and genres, credible dialogue does not imitate actuality. In fact, credibility has no necessary relationship to actuality whatsoever. Characters who live in impossible worlds such as Alice's Wonderland deliver lines that would never be said by a living person, but are true to themselves and true to the settings. In all settings, from the most down-to-earth to the most magical, in all genres, from war stories to musicals, in all styles of speech, from inarticulate monosyllables to lyrical verse, dialogue should sound like the spontaneous talk of its characters. For that reason, we gauge dialogue against the standard of fictional authenticity, not factual accuracy. A character's word choices and syntax should not be so true to life that they imitate the redundant banalities of the everyday. Rather, they should strike us as plausible and vernacular within the context of the story's world and genre or genres. The reader or audience wants to believe that characters speak offstage, off-page, or off-screen exactly as they speak onstage, on the page, or on-screen, no matter how fantasized the story's setting. Even in worlds as fantastic as Guillermo del Toro's film Pan's Labyrinth, or as absurd as Eugene Ionesco's play Exit the King, or as poetic as T.S. Eliot's play Murder in the Cathedral, or as archaic as Robert Graves' novel I, Claudius, the cast's talk need not be factual, but it must seem credible. On the other hand, anyone might say anything at any time. So how do we judge dialogue credibility? How do we know when a line is true to its character and true to the moment, or false on both counts? Aesthetic judgment will never be a science. It is by nature as feeling as it is thoughtful. Instead, you must rely on skilled intuition, on your sense of rightness based on knowledge, experience, and inborn taste. Learn to judge your dialogue by listening past the words and sensing the harmony or disharmony between cause and effect. Dialogue rings true when a character's verbal actions resonate with his motivations, when his inner desires and outer tactics seem to complement each other. Exactly how you will master judgment in your own work is yours to discover. But to help guide you in that goal, what follows is a short list of faults that damage credibility. Empty talk, overly emotive talk, overly knowing talk, overly perceptive talk, and excuses substituting for motivation. Empty talk. When a character speaks, the reader or audience looks into the subtext for a motivation to make sense out of the lines, a cause to explain the effect. If they find none, the dialogue sounds phony and the scene with it. The most common example? one character telling another character something they both already know to satisfy the author's expositional exigencies. Overly emotive talk. When a character uses language that seems far more emotional than his actual feelings, again the reader or audience wonders why and checks the subtext for an explanation. If they find none, they may assume that either this hyperdramatic character is a hysteric, or that the author is desperately trying to make too much out of too little. At some social, psychological level, emotive dialogue and its context should complement each other. Overly knowing talk. Know what your characters know. Characters are an author's creatures, born of exhaustive research into the story setting and cast, countless observations of human behavior, and ruthless self-awareness. A bold line, therefore, runs between creator and created, or should. But if a writer crosses that line and injects his author's knowledge into his character's awareness, we sense a cheat. When a character on screen or on stage talks about current affairs with a breadth and depth of understanding only his author could have, or when a novel's first-person protagonist looks back on past events with factuality and clarity of insight beyond his experience, again, the reader may sense that the author is whispering into his character's ear. Overly perceptive talk. Similarly, beware characters who know themselves better than you know yourself. When a character describes himself with a depth of insight more profound than Freud, Jung, and Socrates combined, readers and audiences not only recoil at the implausibility, they lose faith in the writer. Authors set traps for themselves when they create characters with excessive, unconvincing self-awareness. It happens like this. Hard-working writers fill notebooks and files with character biographies and psychologies, generating 10 or 20 times more material than they could directly use in the writing. They do this, as they must, to give themselves a surfeit of material in order to win the war on clichés with original, unexpected choices. Having amassed this knowledge, the desire to get all they know out into the world can become an irresistible temptation. Unwittingly, the author crosses the line between writer and character, turning his creation into a mouthpiece for his research. Excuses mistaken for motivation. Create honest motivation for behavior. In an effort to match a character's over-the-top action with a cause, writers often backtrack to the character's childhood, insert a trauma, and pass it off as motivation. Over recent decades, episodes of sexual abuse have become an overused, all-purpose, mono-explanation for virtually any extreme behavior. Writers who resort to this kind of psychological shorthand do not understand the difference between excuse and motivation. Motivations, hunger, sleep, sex, power, shelter, love, self-love, etc., are needs that drive human nature and compel behavior. More often than not, these subconscious drives go unrecognized, and as often as not, cause more trouble than they cure. Unwilling to face the truth of why they do what they do, human beings invent excuses. Suppose you were writing a pivotal scene for a political drama in which a national leader explains to his cabinet why he's taking the country to war. Throughout history, two primary motivations have driven one people to war against another. First, the drive for power abroad. Land, slaves, and wealth, seized from the defeated, empowers the victor. Second, the drive for power at home. When rulers fear losing strength, they provoke war to distract their citizens and re-grip domestic power. George Orwell dramatized both motivations in his masterpiece, 1984. These two motivations compel the reality of war, but no ruler who declares war thinks like that, or if he does, he would never say it. So to write your scene, you would have to bury motivation in the subtext, create a leader with just the right quality of self-deception, and then write his dialogue to frame an excuse other characters believe and follow. Some of the excuses warring people have used throughout history include saving souls for God, Christian Crusades, Spanish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, shining the light of civilization into the darkness of savagery, that was the British Empire, manifest destiny, the genocide of Native Americans, purifying the race, the Holocaust, and transforming capitalist tyranny into communist equality, the Russian and Chinese revolutions. For an example of an excuse masquerading as motivation, consider Shakespeare's The Tragedy of Richard III. In Act I, Scene I, Richard, the hunchbacked Duke of Gloucester, says that because his deformity is repellent, he cannot prove a lover. So, instead, he will prove a villain and murder everyone between himself and the throne. Then, in the very next scene, Richard meets Anne, the beautiful widow of a rival he recently assassinated. She hates Richard and curses him, calling him the devil. Nonetheless, Richard, ugly as he is, guilty as he is, mounts a campaign of brilliant psychological seduction. He claims that because Anne is so breathtakingly beautiful, and he is so desperately in love with her, he had to kill her husband in hopes of having her. He then kneels down and offers her his sword so she can kill him, if she wishes. She declines. And by the end of the scene, this blend of flattery and self-pity wins her heart. With that seduction, Richard reveals himself as a masterful lover. So why does he say he is not? Because he needs an excuse to mask his lust for power. To write intriguing, layered, credible dialogue, first study the difference between the two motors for human action, motivation and justification. Then see if masking your character's subconscious drives with their conscious efforts to excuse, or at least to make sense out of their unexplainable behaviors, adds depth to their words. In most cases, false dialogue is not the signature of an overly confident, overly knowledgeable writer, but the opposite, a nervous, unschooled writer. Anxiety is the natural byproduct of ignorance. If you don't know your character beyond his name, if you cannot imagine how he reacts, if you cannot hear his voice, if you write in bewilderment, your hand will scratch out nothing but bogus dialogue. In the fog of not knowing, you have no other choice. Therefore, do the hard work. Surround your character with all the knowledge and imagining you can. Test his traits against the people around him, and most importantly, yourself. For at the end of the day, you are the touchstone of truth. Ask yourself, if I were my character in this situation, what would I say? Then listen with your most truth-sensitive ear for the honest, credible answer. Melodrama. The adjective melodramatic indicts writing for excessiveness, shrill voices, lurid violence, tear-stained sentimentality, or sex scenes one shadow this side of pornography. On the other hand, Shakespeare's The Tragedy of Othello rages with murderous jealousy. Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch turns violence into cinematic poetry. Stephen Sondheim's A Little Night Music explores deep, painful sentiments. And Nagisa Oshima's masterpiece, In the Realm of the Senses, indulges explicit sex, and none of them is melodrama. Long before Oedipus gouged out his eyes, great storytellers have sought the limits of human experience. 21st century artists continue this quest because they sense that the depths and breadths of human nature know no limits. Anything you can picture your characters doing, believe me, human beings have already done it, and in ways beyond imagining. The problem of melodrama, therefore, is not overexpression, but under-motivation. When a writer scores a scene with ping-ponging histrionics, trying to make a snit seem lethal, when he cascades tears down a character's face, hoping to make a setback seem tragic, when he forces behavior to exceed what's actually at stake in the character's life, we dismiss his work as melodrama. Melodramatic dialogue, therefore, is not a matter of word choices. Human beings are capable of doing anything and saying anything while they do it. If you can imagine your character talking in a passionate, pleading, profane, or even violent way, then lift his motivation to match his action. Once you have behavior balanced with desire, take it a step further and ask yourself, would my character state or understate his action? Compare two versions of a cut-off-his-head scene. Suppose Game of Thrones were to develop a plot line in which two kings fight each other in a long war to a blood-soaked end. Then comes the climax. The victorious king sprawls on his throne, his defeated enemy kneels at his feet, awaiting sentencing. A courtier asks the king, "What are your wishes, sire?" And the king screams his answer, "Smash every bone in his body, burn his skin black, peel it off and feed it to him, rip his eyes from his head and his head from his neck." Or the courtier asks the king's wishes, and as the victor examines his manicure, he whispers, "Crucify him." The subtext under "crucify him" implies a death as hideous as the screamed answer, but which answer conveys greater personal power? The lurid, harsh, overstated rant, or the simple, understated "crucify him"? Either answer could be perfectly in character, but what kind of character? The first answer implies a weak king at the mercy of his emotions. The second suggests a powerful king in command of his emotions. In the matter of melodrama, motivation and character are never separate. What would drive one character over a cliff wouldn't get another character off his sofa. Therefore, the balance of motivation versus action is unique in every role and has to be struck inside a character who first feels it and then does it. Chapter 7. Language Flaws. Clichés. Clichés are scenes we've seen too many times before, acted with predictable behaviors, mouthed in dialogue we can recite before the actor says a word. Like the weeds of repetition, clichés grow in the barren mind of the lazy writer. Many wannabes assume that writing is easy, or it should be, and so they try to make it easy by rummaging through the trash of old stories and pulling out the same tired phrases they've heard or read 100 times in the same tired scenes they've seen or read 1,000 times. Why lazy writers lack originality is no mystery. But why do diligent professional authors who should know better also resort to clichés? Because they work. Once upon a time, today's hackneyed expressions were inspired creative choices. In Casablanca, 1942, Captain Renault's gem-quality imperative, round up the usual suspects, encapsulated political corruption in five smart words. Since then, the phrase, the usual suspects, has topped the list of the usual cliched suspects in dozens of dictionaries devoted to cliches. Somewhere in humanity's past, a cave-dwelling storyteller first described a teardrop in a character's eyes to express sorrow, and everybody around the fire felt a wave of sadness. Once upon a time, a king's raconteur first compared an enemy's military trap to a spider's web, and the whole palace felt a rush of fear. Although time has dulled the cliché's edge, the original invention was so sharp, it still cuts a sliver of truth. Here, for example, is a short list of clichés that frequently find their way into modern dialogue. To set a limit, I restricted the slate to phrases that begin with the letters B-A. Backseat driver, back to basics, back to square one, back to the drawing board, bad hair day, bag of tricks, ballpark figure, balls in your court, bang your head against a brick wall, barking up the wrong tree, battle royal, and the list goes on. Familiarity breeds comfort. People, on occasion, enjoy a cliché because it signals cultural continuity. The past is still present. What people loved in their childhood, they still love today. For that reason, clichés infect everyday talk. People use them because, trite or not, they make immediate sense. As a result, the infrequent cliché adds verisimilitude. Just remember this. Sooner or later, every cliché reaches its use-by date and becomes so odorous the world finally turns away in disgust. To create fresh, original dialogue, set high standards and never settle for the obvious choice. Indeed, never settle for the first choice. Just write it down, then improvise, experiment, go a little crazy, pour out as many choices as your talent can create. Let your character say any off-the-wall thing that comes into her head. By playing with every wild thing you can imagine, you might discover that one of your lunatic choices is crazy but brilliant. At the end of the day, make your best choice, then cut the rest. No one has to see your weak choices unless you're foolish enough to leave them on the page. Character-neutral language. Character-neutral language substitutes generality for specificity. When writers use the stale language of everyday talk, they defend their vapidities once again with appeals to verisimilitude, and again, they would be correct. For when you turn an objective ear to the talk around you, banalities and clichés do indeed echo and re-echo down the caverns of conversation. In states of surprise, for example, people call upon their deities. "Oh my God," naturally pops out of the startled. As dialogue, however, this ready-made phrase robs the actor of a chance to create a revealing, character-specific moment. What to do? Ask yourself this question. If my character, in a state of shock, were to call upon God, how would she and she alone do it? If she were from Alabama, would she say, "Sweet bleeding Jesus"? If she were from Detroit, would she look up at the sky and plead, "Lord, have mercy"? If she were from New York, would she call upon the devil instead and curse, "Well, damn me to hell"? Whatever your choice, find words so true to your character they wouldn't quite fit in anyone else's mouth. We'll examine character-specific language in depth in Part 3. Ostentatious language. In a dialogue scene near the end of James Joyce's A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, the novel's protagonist, Stephen Dedalus, and Lynch, his friend, debate aesthetics. To clinch his argument, Stephen describes the ideal relationship between an author and his finished work in these words. The artist, like the god of creation, remains within or behind or beyond or above his handiwork, invisible, refined out of existence, indifferent, paring his fingernails. Joyce's analogy advocates a writing method that so harmonizes characters and events that telling seems authorless. Applied to dialogue, the Joycean ideal becomes talk so true to the vocal personalities that any hint of string pulling vanishes. Rather, each spoken word draws us deeper and deeper into the storytelling, holding us spellbound to the end. Ostentatiousness breaks that spell. By ostentatious dialogue, I mean self-conscious displays of literariness, lines so unnecessarily expressive, so clearly out of character, that they call attention to the writing as writing. The worst of these jumps out of the scene, waving pom-poms in celebration of its author's victory, declaring, "Oh, what a clever line am I." Like stand-up comics who laugh at their own jokes, like exhibitionistic athletes who dance in the end zone, literary swagger celebrates its success. But the instant a line of dialogue makes the reader or audience aware of art as art, the bond of belief fused between them and the character snaps. As we noted in the as-if discussion in Chapter 5, when people open a book or sit down as an audience, they shift their mental gears from the factual to the fictional mode. They know that to take part in the ritual of story, they must willingly believe in imaginary characters as if they were real and react to fictional events as if they were actually happening. It's a childlike state, so a bond of trust must run through the story, that ancient contract that conjoins a reader or audience to an author. That's the deal. And no matter how realistic or fantasied the genre, the bond will hold so long as the reader or audience finds the dialogue true to the characters who speak it. The moment technique becomes visible, dialogue rings false. The reader or audience loses trust, the bond breaks, and the scene fails. Break belief often enough, the reader or audience tears up the contract and tosses your work in the trash. Of all aspects of characterization, dress, gesture, age, sexuality, mood, facial expression, speech is by far the most susceptible to disbelief. Odd phrasings, eccentric word choices, even out-of-place pauses can betray the odor of bad acting, false emotions, shallow mind, and hollow heart. That's why every line of dialogue puts the writer under pressure to maintain the bond of credibility. As an author, you must develop taste enough to sense the shift from expressivity to exhibitionism. To do so, first, test the limits of language your medium imposes. What could be said with moving conviction on page may be embarrassingly unactable on stage. Because the marker dividing veracity from falsity is set as much by tradition as by authorship, first identify your story's genre or genres, and then study the conventions. Finally, bring your best judgment to bear by asking this question. If I were my character, in these circumstances, what would I say? The only curbs on garishness are your innate taste and schooled judgment. So let your inner acumen be your guide. When in doubt, tone it down. Arid language. The opposite of ostentation is desert dry, Latinate, polysyllabic language composed in long sentences strung out over long speeches. The suggestions that follow help avoid arid speech in favor of natural, unaffected, seemingly spontaneous dialogue. But always bear in mind that these points, like all else in this book, are guidelines, not imperatives. Every writer has to find her own way. Prefer the concrete to the abstract. Would a 21st century character call her home a domicile or her car a vehicle? Doubtful. On the other hand, there may be people who would. So if you have a character-specific reason for your role's formality, then by all means give her an abstract vocabulary. Otherwise, keep it real with specific names for objects and actions.